off and walked up the hill with us. It had only been a few hours since I left for school that morning, but as I entered the house, it felt as though I'd been away for a year. The smallest things seemed so welcoming. The vase Mom had made in her pottery class filled with dried cattails, the small mahogany table with the picture of me from sixth grade, the way Dad's dirt cake work boots rested on a piece of newspaper inside the door. I put Ben's things on the floor and wiped Tilly off with an old bath towel we kept in a basket inside the front door. Then I took off my wet shoes and went down the hall to my room. When I opened the door, a bubbling underwater sound filled my ears. It was only the fish tank screensaver I'd left on the computer, but I turned it off before taking a long, hot shower. By the time I was getting dressed again, I could hear my father's voice in the kitchen. Mom had a cup of hot chocolate waiting for me and pulled out a chair. "Good job, Brady," Dad said, shaking my hand, then pulling me over for a big hug. He was wet to the bone, but I didn't care. "Some morning, wasn't it?" "Unbelievable," I said. "Where were you?" "Most of us went on down the river toward Queenstown, thinking the current pulled the kayak that way. We figured they'd all end up in the bay, probably down toward the bridge somewhere." "You know, it was Tilly who made me look over toward that little place off the river," I told Dad. "I'm not sure I would have gone in there and seen Ben if Tilly hadn't barked up a storm." "Good girl," Dad clapped his hand softly, and Tilly rushed to him for a vigorous scratch behind the ears. "I forgot about that place," I told Dad. "You know where I'm talking about? JT, Digger, and I used to go fishing there. Swimming, too, sometimes." "Oh, yeah, there's an old dock." "That's it," I said.
"Well, I'll be."
Dad shook his head and patted my shoulder. Then he went to change into dry clothes. Afterwards, we sat at the kitchen table for a long time, talking about everything, so Mom heard the whole story a couple of times. She made us thick turkey sandwiches, then cut up an apple and sliced some cheese. Both Dad and I were starved for lunch. It felt great to have done what I did and to have both my parents so proud of me. They didn't even care about the cell phone I lost. Dad dismissed it with a wave of his hand. "We can get another one of those easy." Before we even finished eating, though, the telephone started ringing. Word had gotten around. The first call was from Carl, who had just driven the ambulance back to the station. My father talked to him briefly, then handed me the phone.
"You okay?" Carl asked.
"Fine," I said. "How's Ben?"
"They airlifted him over to Children's Hospital down in D.C., Carl said.
"Did his mother go, too?"
"No, but his father was there."
"He went," Carl said.
"They took the mother down to Easton, but I think she's okay, Brady. She was able to talk a little after they got her warmed up at the hospital."
"Did she tell you what happened?" I still didn't know how they lost the kayak.
"She says it was getting windy and rough. She tried to take it to shore, some little cove somewhere," she said. "She was almost to shore but couldn't quite make it because the kayak was so full of water. All of a sudden," she said, "it was gone. She said she managed to hook Ben to a piece of old piling before she got pulled out with the current."
"How long were they in the water?" I asked.
"She's not sure."
"Did she say why, Carl? Why'd they go out there on such a bad day?"
"Ben wanted a ride before they went away for a couple of days. She said he loved that kayak and begged for one little ride before they left."
While he was talking, I tried to picture in my mind what had happened and felt all over again how scared they must have been.
"I just wanted to tell you what a super job you did, Brady. Everyone's talking about it. Down here at the station, we're real proud of you. I told your dad, I said, let the kid take tomorrow off, he deserves it." "Oh, thanks, Carl, but I can't. I've got a social studies exam." "Suit yourself," Carl said. "You want a ride in the morning? I'll flash my lights for you all the way."
"Nah, it's okay." I knew tomorrow was Carl's day off. "I can take the bus."
"All right, but you take it easy, you hear?"
"I will." We hung up, and right away the phone rang again. This time it was Captain Dressler from the fire department
telling me what a superb effort I had made. He said he was going to recommend me for some kind of award. Later, after school was out, the phone rang some more. Two kids from my class wanted to know if it was true. My Uncle Henry, down in Graysonville, called to say he heard about it at the gas station. Then, at 8 o'clock that night, when I was taking Tilly outside, a reporter called. I had talked to a reporter once before, when I was 9, and a newspaper did a story on me being one of the youngest kids in Maryland to have a commercial crab license. It was different then because Mom and Dad were with me, and they did half the talking. This time, Mom asked me first if I wanted to be interviewed. When I shrugged, she handed me the phone and went back to the kitchen. "Here," Dad offered. "I'll take Tilly outside." I sat down in Dad's chair in the living room and put my feet up on the hassock while the reporter and I talked. He seemed like a nice guy. Craig somebody. He said what I did was pretty amazing, and he wanted to hear the whole story. Everything. So I told him. Except that I didn't include how we'd seen the red kayak that morning, and how we didn't bother to call out a warning.
"Were you scared?" Craig asked me.
"Of what?"
"Of getting lost out there yourself. Or maybe not finding him in time." I sort of snorted. I wasn't afraid of getting lost, because I know the river pretty well. But I was worried that if they were in the water, the coal would get to them before any of us could.
"They tell me you knew the kid. What's his name? Ben?"
I could hear him tapping on his computer.
"You took care of Ben a couple of times?"
"I babysat for him once," I said.
"So you're pretty relieved he survived."
"Very relieved," I assured him.
"Are you worried about what might happen to him yet?"
"What do you mean?" I asked. Craig somebody paused.
"You know, are you worried that Ben was in the cold water so long he'll have some kind of permanent brain damage or something?"
Man, I had not even thought of that.
"Brady? Brady, you there?"
"Yeah, I'm here," I sort of mumbled into the phone. "Sure, I'm worried." We wrapped it up then. I told him I needed to go. Craig somebody said that the story would likely lead the state page in the morning, but I told him we didn't get the Baltimore paper. When we were finished, I hung up and told my mother that I just wanted to study for tomorrow's exam and get to bed early. I also had some Spanish homework. No way was Senora Mendez going to let me off the hook just because I rescued someone. But the truth was, I didn't want to take any more calls. I was talked out. Plus, I couldn't stand the thought that Ben might end up with some kind of brain damage. I took a grocery bag and went to my room, where I closed the door. First thing I did was pull the plastic box out from my closet and noisily paw through all the Legos, picking out the red and black Aquanauts with the little oxygen tanks on their backs. Then I scooped up two of the sharks, a white one and a gray one. Ben would like the sharks, I thought, the way they could open and close their jaws. I put the bag on my desk and sat on the edge of my bed, thinking. At the nursing home where my mother worked, one of the patients had a grandson named Andy who had brain damage. Andy, in his wheelchair, came to visit a lot because he didn't have much else to do. Sometimes they left Andy there all day to sit in the common room where the residents played bingo or cards. The residents didn't mind. If I happened to walk in to see Mom or something, I always went over to Andy and said, "Hi, how's it going?" I know he can hear because he moves his head, but he can't quite focus or work his hands the right way to wave. Man, I just couldn't stand to see Ben like that, all twisted in a wheelchair. I reached over for a pillow, doubled it up, and hit it hard with my fist. I'd rather be dead, I thought, than brain damaged. Chapter 7. In the morning, it was non-stop from the minute Dad came back from the 7-Eleven with three copies of the Baltimore paper. He spread out the Maryland page on the table so we could see the headline and the story.
Boy rescues toddler from river.
A 13-year-old Eastern Shore boy, alone in his 14-foot skiff, plucked a 3-year-old from the frigid waters of the Corsica River yesterday afternoon and resuscitated the child while speeding through pelting rain to waiting rescuers.
Braden Brady Parks was one of a dozen people, including fire and rescue, law enforcement officials, and watermen, who responded to an emergency call yesterday morning that Virginia D'Angelo, 30, and her young son, Benjamin, were missing on the river. Virginia D'Angelo was reported in good condition this morning at Eastern General Hospital, while Benjamin, who was flown to the pediatric intensive care unit at Children's Hospital, remains in critical condition. Both suffered from prolonged exposure in waters estimated at 48 degrees yesterday when their kayak overturned. Thomas Parks, a waterman who aided the rescue effort, summoned his son Brady from school.
"I figured Brady knew those waters as well as anybody," Mr. Parks said.
But the younger Parks insisted he could not have done it alone.
"Part of the credit goes to my dog Tilly," said Brady,
an eighth grader at Alexander Holmes Middle School.
"She pointed me in the right direction."
So on and so forth, the whole story. On the bus, the driver saluted me. And at school, all kinds of people patted me on the shoulder, shook my hand, or gave me a thumbs up. While I was at my locker, Mrs. Owens, the principal, came over and put her arm around my shoulders.
"Good for you," she said into my ear, embarrassing the heck out of me because I was surrounded by kids who overheard everything she said. "I received a call from Channel 13 in Baltimore. They want to come out this afternoon and do an interview."
"Is it okay with my parents?" I asked.
"It's fine with them. Do you want to do it?"
I had never been on television before. Lauren Modley hugged her books and stared at me, her eyes doubling in size.
"Sure," I said, shrugging.
Not too long afterward, eighth grade had an assembly in the gym to talk about the upcoming orientation day we were going to have over at the county high school. And at the end of it, Mrs. Owens announced,
"If you haven't already heard, we have a bona fide hero in our midst this morning, Brady Parks." Everyone in my class stood up and clapped. I know I blushed from head to toe, but man, what I wouldn't give to experience that moment again. It was terrific how everyone at school responded. Everyone except for JT and Digger, that is. My best friends. They didn't come over to wait for the bus with me that morning, and although I spotted them at the assembly, they didn't save me a seat or anything, so I didn't get to talk to them. And I never knew what they were thinking. Were they sorry we hadn't called out to Mrs. D'Angelo? Embarrassed because they had cheered on a near tragedy? What? What were they thinking? It started to hurt my feelings that they never sought me out. But I wasn't going to let on that I was miffed. I even had an oxymoron ready for JT. When I saw him and he commented on the rescue, I was going to say, "Yeah, it was pretty ugly." The other thing was this. Almost the whole time in school, I didn't let myself think anything bad was going to happen to Ben. I was a little swept up in being a hero, I guess. I'd never been one before, and it felt pretty neat. Plus, I was sure that if something was wrong with Ben, the doctors at the hospital would have known it by then. Someone would have told me. Still, every once in a while, I couldn't help but think about that reporter's question, and a sick feeling churned my stomach. I was eager to tell JT about it. I decided I'd say something to him when we were together in social studies class right after lunch, before we took the exam. But by then, everything had flipped upside down, and I was gone. Taken out of school, fast, by my mother.
Chapter 8
"Brady, I need to talk to you." Mom's voice, so close, startled me. I whirled around from my locker. "What in the world?" "Please, Brady," she said firmly, grabbing my forearm. "Outside. I need to talk to you." I was a little stunned. It wasn't like either of my parents to just show up in school the way they had the last 2 days. But I didn't argue. Mom was harried. In fact, her hair wasn't totally dry, and I realized that she was wearing the purple sweater she only wears to work, but with a pair of jeans, like she was half-dressed. Pushing our way through all the kids and commotion, I followed her to the front entrance. I thought sure someone would make a wisecrack. But no one seemed to notice my mother. If they did, they didn't care. "Way to go, Brady," one boy down the hall yelled. When the heavy front doors closed behind us, we looked at each other. It was cold and neither one of us had a jacket.
"What is it?" I asked.
She hesitated and started rubbing her arms to get warm. But then she decided she wasn't going to tell me there, on the front steps of the school, either. "Let's get in the car for a minute," she said, heading off toward our Jeep, which was parked at the curb.
It was getting weird.
We got into the front seats, and when my mother pulled her door closed and sighed, it hit me. She had bad news about Ben. Ben was in a coma or something. He did have brain damage. Somehow they already knew that he would never be the same. Instead, Mom turned to me and said, "Ben died." At first, I didn't think I heard right.
"What? What did you say?"
"Ben is dead, Brady. He died this morning. It was on the news. I thought I'd better get to school before someone told you in the hallway, or those television people showed up."
"But he was alive," I tried to argue. "Carl had a pulse."
"I know." She looked down at the steering wheel and nodded. The news threw me off. Slowly, I fell back in the seat and stared straight out the windshield. As I did, the Cloverland Dairy milk truck pulled away from where it was backed up to the school for delivery. When it passed in front of us, the smiling black-and-white cow painted on its side was unavoidable. And in that instant, I thought to myself, Ben is never going to drink any more milk. Stupid. But that was my first thought. Ben would never drink another cup of milk from those little spout cups of his. I felt my mother's hand touch mine.
"I am so sorry, Brady," she said. "I know this is going to be hard for you."
"Why?" I demanded, turning to her. "Why did he die?"
Mom's eyes shone. I could see she'd been crying, and figured this hurt her too, because it was a little like when we lost Amanda.
"I don't know," she replied.
When she blinked, a tear ran down her cheek.
"I guess because he was in that cold water for so long."
I felt my own eyes fill up. "Shoot," I exclaimed, kicking at a Kleenex box on the floor. "I should have gotten there faster."
"No, Brady."
Mom tried to grab my hand, but I pulled it away and put it up over my face.
"It's not your fault. Don't you dare blame yourself. You tried, Brady. You did everything you could. If you hadn't found him and done what you did, he wouldn't have had any chance. You at least gave him that."
"Did I? Did I do everything I could?"
An enormous hole opened in my chest. I took in a huge gulp of air and held it for a moment. Then I grew still. When I took my hand away from my eyes, I saw the dairy truck disappear down the highway and watched the noisy sixth graders run out onto the field for gym. If we talked any more, I can't remember. All I know is Mom said, "Let's go home." And we did. For a while, I sat at the kitchen table numb, while Mom called school and made sure the television interview had been canceled. Then I moved into my room and sat at the end of my bed, staring at the floor. I started thinking the only thing I wanted to do was go find that red kayak and bring it in. It seemed like a small, insignificant thing. The D'Angelos probably would never want to see it again, but it's all I could think of doing. So I changed into grubby jeans and reached for my hat, my Baltimore Orioles cap, but then I thought, no, this was the hat that Ben wore just before he died. Not that I'm superstitious, but I didn't feel right about it. I set it down on my bureau and took another instead, then grabbed one of Dad's winter coats, because now both of mine were gone, one in the ambulance with Ben and the other one at school, and headed down to the dock. Tilly followed at my heels. She wanted to come in the worst way, but I wouldn't let her in the boat. I don't know why. "Go on," I hollered at her when she barked and tried to hop in after I undid the lines. I motored straight to the spot in the cove where I had found Ben, cut off the engine, and let the boat drift. I was trying real hard not to think of how I messed up,
how I could have called out a warning when we first saw them. But even if I had yelled, would Mrs. D'Angelo have heard me? And if she had, would she have listened? Who knows? I should have tried, though. At least then she would have been alerted to the danger, and maybe she would have come back before it was too late. Or maybe I could have found Ben earlier. Just think, if I hadn't gone up that other creek first, if I'd gotten there 5 minutes sooner. The fact that I went from being a hero to a great big nothing in just a few hours didn't bother me. The other stuff was too big. The water was calm, solid brown because of how the rain had stirred everything up the day before. You could still smell the storm, the wet logs, the damp grass, the muddy riverbank. I knew I'd never find the kayak. Most likely it had gone out with the tide and floated downriver. Either that or it was washed up somewhere along the bay's shore. Maybe even as far south as the bay bridge. A kayak was pretty hard to sink. It would turn up eventually, but what would it matter? What was I going to do with it anyway? Usually, being out on the water made me feel free. Whenever things at school bothered me, I went out on the water to shake it off. But that day, all it did was make me sick to my stomach. I noticed how, nearby, the roots to a big sweet gum tree, exposed by erosion in the riverbank, suddenly looked like a swarm of snakes slithering into the water. Just then, the eagle flew over and split the air in half with his terrible screech. Made me jump, it was so loud. You hardly ever saw the eagle. A pair of them lived nearby, let alone heard one. But I figured it was yelling at me. It saw everything that happened in the river yesterday, and it was letting me know. Unfair, I thought. My teeth clenched and a tremendous surge of anger burst out of me. You didn't have to kill him, I screamed at the river. My voice echoed in the hollow that surrounded the quiet cove. Kill him, kill him, kill him. You didn't have to be so cold, I accused. But the anger was gone, turned into something else already. You didn't have to make Ben die, I muttered before I began to cry. Some people, I guess, they'd be railing at God for letting a thing like that happen. But me, I cussed out the river. And you know what? Nothing happened. When I finished crying, there wasn't a sound to be heard except for the gentlest lap of waves on the nearby sandbar. The river didn't care. A strange, chilly feeling settled around me then, like an invisible fog. What was I going to do? And whatever compelled me to look down, I'll never know. But this is the truth. When I leaned over to peer into the river, the water was not brown and full of sediment, but perfectly clear. And at the bottom, a few feet down, I could see the red kayak. Chapter 9. It freaked me out seeing that kayak under the water. At home, I hid in my room and didn't tell either of my parents about it. I halfway thought I was going nuts, and that kind of thinking scared me a little. Mom brought me some dinner, a grilled cheese and some soup, but it sat there growing cold until I gave the sandwich to Tilly. Dad came in later. He was worn out from crabbing all day. I was at my desk and pushed my chair back, glad that Dad had come in.
Good run, he reported. Hauled in 15 bushels. Mostly females, though, he said, disappointed.
Females didn't bring in half the value of a good-sized Jimmy. I hoped Dad would sit on the end of my bed and stay, because I wanted to tell him how twisted up I felt inside.
Glad you ate the sandwich, he said. I glanced at Tilly. Your mother was getting worried. You know how she is.
I'm okay, I said too quickly. I think I am anyway. I'm not sure. My father pushed his hands into his pockets.
Look, Brady, he said. Don't be blaming yourself. You were a hero yesterday for all you'd done. Finding Ben and giving him CPR and getting him on down to Rock Hall. We're proud of what you'd done. The way it turned out... He shook his head. It's not your fault. I just don't want you to be blaming yourself, son.
I nodded. I appreciated everything he said, but he didn't know how bad I felt about not calling out a warning when I'd seen the kayak that morning, before school.
You can stay home tomorrow if you want.
Thanks, I said,
but a day off from school was not what I needed.
I wanted to tell Dad about how scared I was, how I still felt responsible. The words stuck in my throat, though.
Dad sighed. Why don't you turn in? Get you some sleep.
I knew Dad hated to talk about feelings and stuff like that. It's one reason my mother left for such a long time after Amanda died. Leastways, that's what I heard her tell Grandma once on the telephone. You know, Tom, I can't tell him how I feel about anything.
Well, I'm gonna hit the tick, Dad said, turning to go. Gotta get up early and make a run before that nor'easter comes in. More rain, they're saying.
I nodded. I knew I'd lost my chance to talk. Softly, Dad closed the door. After he left, I sat staring at the Michael Jordan poster on the back of my bedroom door. JT and Digger had the same poster because we played basketball a lot. I gave them the poster when Jordan made his comeback with the Washington Wizards. I turned around then and powered up the computer to see if there was any email for me, and saw that I had two messages. One from Lauren Modley, saying she was really sorry for what had happened to the little boy, and what a brave thing I had done. The other from JT. It wasn't much, just this. Brady, sorry for what happened.
At least he had acknowledged it, I thought.
That night, I couldn't sleep. For hours I lay in my bed thinking about the D'Angelos and wondering what they were doing. I knew that Mrs. D'Angelo was in the hospital, but where was Mr. D'Angelo? Was he at the hospital too? Or was he home alone, watching TV, or sitting on his back steps crying? And what about Ben? Did they cover him up with a sheet the way you see in the movies? Was he in a room alone? Where? Was his spirit up in heaven already? And what was that like? Would he, or his parents, ever know how hard I tried? I got up twice to get a drink of water. I got up just to look out the window. And I got up once to take Tilly outside and stood for a long time in my mother's butterfly garden outside the back kitchen door. It was clear and cold, with just enough moonlight to see the little brick path Dad had made. All the different bushes, so pretty in summer, were brown and broken from the long winter. But there was a measure of comfort standing in the butterfly garden, because I knew it was there for Amanda. The sweet, painful memory of my sister had paled over the years, but I would never forget. I was 7 years old when she came and went, and we never, ever talked about Amanda. We don't even refer to her, leastways not in front of my mother. There is nothing in our house to even suggest Amanda ever existed. Not a stuffed animal, or a picture, or a piece of her clothing. Nothing. My parents packed some stuff in a trunk and got rid of the rest. Then they locked that trunk and put it in a corner of the attic. The only thing left was Amanda's name on the back of Dad's boat, and Dad wasn't about to paint over it. Despite my mother, he stood his ground on that one. I scuffed down the brick path a ways and thought about how some things had changed forever that morning my parents found Amanda in her crib, not breathing. My mother blamed herself. She kept crying about how she should have checked on the baby during the night, and I wondered if Mrs. D'Angelo would blame herself the same way. Would she regret not telling Ben it was too cold to go out in the kayak? Or that they didn't have time? Or that she couldn't find the life jackets? God, I thought, why didn't I just yell something? In my weaker moments, I still think she might have heard me. Back inside, I tried to sleep again, but I couldn't even close my eyes. At 4 a.m., when I heard Dad get up to go crabbing, I got up to go with him. Maybe out there, we'd find time to talk, I thought. Maybe that would help. I wasn't sure. I only knew that I couldn't sleep and didn't want to be in bed, alone in the dark anymore.
You're up?
Dad rubbed his eyes. He was surprised, but he is not one to make a big deal out of anything. I want to go with you. He didn't blink an eye.
All right by me, he said. Why don't you fix us some sandwiches while I get dressed?
I was glad for the work. I put together 4 thick sandwiches with cold cuts, American cheese, and lots of mustard and mayonnaise. Put them in little plastic bags and threw them in a cooler with some blue ice and a couple of apples and bananas. I tossed in a box of Oreos, too, then a big bottle of grapefruit juice for Dad and 2 cans of Dr. Pepper for me. By the time I was finished making lunch and got myself dressed, Dad had fixed his thermos of coffee and was ready to go, too. We headed out together, Tilly left to whimper inside the back door. Because it was still dark, we had to use a flashlight to see our way down to the tool shed, where my father kept his bait and 2 old refrigerators. We pulled out 5 bushels of brown razor clams, dumped them in our baskets, and carried them down to the workboat. It took us 2 trips to get all the bait on board. While Dad checked everything on the Miss Amanda, the water, the oil, the fuel, I turned on the radar, flipped the lights on and off, and turned both the VHF and the AM/FM radio on. Dad liked the country music station out of Baltimore, which drove me nuts. But I left it on low, figuring I'd better not say anything since I was missing a day of school to be there. By 5:30, we were ready to set out. Dad liked working his first hour or so in the dark because he could beat the wind that way. The wind comes up between 8 and 10 in the morning, and if it's in your face, it makes the job more time-consuming. You gotta beat the wind to make time, Dad always says, and you gotta make time. Outside in the brisk air, with a few early songbirds starting up and our eyes getting used to the darkness, I felt a little bit better. Like somehow, life was going on. After we cast off the lines, Dad let me go up front to the doghouse to drive the workboat out of its slip into the creek. Then he came in a few seconds later to pick up the radio and check in with his best waterman friend, Kenny O'Leary. Kenny kept his boat up near Rock Hall with most of the local crabbers and was just stocking his boat, so Dad said, "See you out there," as we left the creek and turned into the river. If you kept going south on down past Queenstown, the river would hook around in the west, then the north, and empty into the Chesapeake Bay. But mostly we crabbed the river. We didn't talk about Ben or what had happened. We stepped into our rubber overalls, pulled on our rubber gloves, and started winching in crab pots, dumping out crabs and refilling the bait holders with clams. I figured that eventually the subject would come up. About an hour later, there was a beautiful sunrise.
"Looky there," Dad said,
pausing to wipe sweat off his forehead with the back of his hand. We paused a moment to marvel at how the rising rim of gold sun silently announced itself by illuminating the sky with brilliant broad streaks of pink, purple, and orange.
"Just think," Dad went on as he plucked out a small crab from the wooden bin where everything from each pot got dumped and sorted. "You and me, Brady, we've seen more sunrises in a month than some people see their whole lives."
He tossed the undersized crab back in the water. It was true. A good sunrise was awesome. I watched the little crab dart away beneath the waves. His second chance, I thought. Maybe he'd live and grow big enough to become a keeper one day. At 10 a.m., we sat on top of the huge engine box in the middle of the boat and had lunch. By then, I was pretty hungry, but after half a sandwich, I didn't feel like eating anymore. Dad noticed.
"You can change the station if you want."
"That's okay," I told him. I wish he had asked how I was feeling instead. "It's not the station," I said. But he didn't bite. Still, being out there with Dad, seeing that beautiful sky, it should have done more for me. By late morning, we had several bushels of crab sitting there, all separated in bushel baskets. There was a short row, 4 bushels of #1 males, those 5 3/4 inches or more, then 3 baskets of mixed males, 5 to 5 3/4, and 4 bushel baskets of females.
"Was a time when I'd have twice as many crabs here for the work we'd done this morning," Dad said soberly as he surveyed the catch.
"But the price is up," I said, shrugging. "We caught less, but we made more per bushel, didn't we?" My father lifted his cap and scratched the back of his head.
"Ain't the same, Brady, and I worry about it."
When Dad went up front to answer a call on the radio, I stood for a long time staring down at the haul we'd made, watching the crabs while they blew bubbles and snapped at one another. I remember thinking how pretty they were, with their moist olive-green shells and that bright blue stripe down their claws. And I had the odd thought about how this was the end for them. There would be no more second chances, no more swimming in the beautiful bay or up the Corsica River. They'd be in somebody's steamer that night. This was not a normal way to think. Not for me. But a dark sense of dread washed over me, and I almost couldn't breathe. It had nothing to do with the scarcity of crabs or feeling sorry for the bay. No. It was all because of Ben. Ben, who didn't get his second chance, who wouldn't grow up now. I was suffocating and no one knew it. I had to do something. So I flipped out. I mean, how else would you explain the fact that all of a sudden I started picking up those baskets and dumping everything back overboard? Chapter 10.
"Brady, stop!" Dad hollered.
But by the time he saw me dumping the crabs, there were only 2 bushels left.
"What the hell are you doing?"
he demanded, seizing my wrist with one hand and the basket with his other. I couldn't look at him.
"Brady!"
All I felt was empty inside. Empty and removed, as though it wasn't even me who was standing there.
"What's going on?"
he shouted at me. I cringed, but I couldn't answer. Disgusted, Dad threw down my hand and kicked the last 2 baskets up toward the front of the boat. I heard him cuss under his breath, but then nothing more. Silence as we rowed home on the boat. Neither Mom nor Dad knew what to say or how to start a conversation with me. So I went to my room down the hall and listened to my parents' hushed voices.
"Off the deep end. I don't know. For crying out loud.
But I'm worried, Tom." Then I heard my mother call Carl and ask him to come over. I waited inside my door, biting my thumbnail. It hit me then how my parents couldn't talk to me. It's like they wanted to help, but they didn't know how. When Mom finished and hung up the phone, I heard her say that Carl had to be in Easton for a meeting, but that he'd stop by on the way. I was relieved Carl was coming. I changed and waited for him in the kitchen. When he came in, he had my parka, the one I had wrapped around Ben. My mother took it and gave Carl back the jacket the police officer had lent me. It occurred to me she must have quietly gotten rid of Ben's jacket, too. That and his life jacket. I hadn't seen them around the house. Carl and I pulled out chairs at the kitchen table.
"We're going to get a pizza," Mom said as she and my father came through the room. "We'll bring it back, Carl, if you want to stay and eat with us."
"Thanks, I'm all set," Carl replied.
Mom picked up her purse. As Dad put his cap on and opened the door for her, I thought how easy he'd been on me considering what I had done. All that work and he'd brought home a measly 2 bushels. I began to feel unbelievably stupid and ungrateful for doing that to him. To us. What I did affected the whole family. After my parents were gone, Carl unzipped his brown leather jacket and rested his strong arms on the table. He seemed just a little bit uncomfortable, but I was sure he would say the right thing. Carl is one smart person, and he's got a good heart, too. If anyone had the answer, it was him. I remember once when Carl worked with the toll facilities police, how he stopped the woman from jumping off the Chesapeake Bay Bridge just by talking to her. He never would tell me exactly what he said. None of those guys are supposed to talk about it. But whatever it was, it must have been good. So I listened up, even if I didn't look up. Carl pressed his thick fingers together. "You know,"
he finally began. Every time we get a call, Brady, a car accident or a hunting incident, and somebody dies at the scene, it's very distressing to us. I lifted my eyes. Even though we know someone has died, we keep going back to recheck, to make sure the person has, you know, passed on. It's a little like we can't quite believe it. He shrugged. Can't quite accept it, because see? He opened his hands. Here we have all this training, all this skill, and sometimes it's simply too late. Or for some reason it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't necessarily our fault, because we didn't get there in time. Carl paused. In the end, there isn't anything more we can do. We need to put it behind us, so we can move on to the next one. If we didn't, we would be totally burned out. You need to do the same thing, Brady, he said, waiting until our eyes connected. You need to talk it out. People have these feelings, you know. You need to talk it out and put it behind you so you can move forward. I looked away again, but I knew Carl needed me to respond. A little nod was all I could manage. I didn't know how to express what I was feeling, which as far as I could tell then was a combination of guilt for what I hadn't done, anger because of what did happen, and enormous sadness for Ben and his family. Maybe that's what I should have told him. It took me a while, but I was getting my thoughts together when Carl stood up. He shouldn't have stood up. Another few seconds, maybe, I could have gotten something out. You sure you don't want to talk about it? He asked. It was obvious he needed to get going because he glanced at his watch. I nodded again. I didn't want to hold him back. Look, I gotta run, Brady. But if you change your mind and want to talk, give me a holler. You know where I am. I stared at the table, disappointed, while Carl zipped up his jacket. Wait, I said when Carl reached for the door handle, because there was one thing I had to know. He turned around. I just wondered what happened. I mean, why did Ben die? I felt my voice quaver. I thought you guys had a pulse. Carl came back to the table and sat down. He forced me to look at him. We did have a pulse, Brady. There is no question you brought him back. I swallowed hard. I hoped Carl wouldn't think less of me for getting tears in my eyes. But he had a lot of water in his lungs, and it gave him pneumonia. What they call aspiration pneumonia, Carl explained. That on top of the exposure, it was too much. I dropped my eyes again and was trying real hard to hold everything in. Carl cleared his throat a little. He went fast, they tell me. Kids, when they go down, they go fast. I wiped at my eyes with the heel of my hand. Don't beat yourself, Brady, Carl said. You did a great thing. You tried. You gave it your best, and that's what matters. Carl ended up staying until my parents came back with a pizza, but then he left. Mom and Dad still seemed worried about me. Dad even said I could hang out at home again the next day if I wanted. But I guess the talk with Carl did me a little good after all, because what I said was, "Thanks, but it's time to move on." I tried. I tried the best I could. In my room, I put away the bag of Legos and slid my heavy backpack over to my desk. I took a shower, reviewed material for the social studies exam I had missed, and hung a clean shirt on the drawer pull of my bureau. But at school the next day, I couldn't seem to pick up where I had left off. I knew I avoided looking at people. I just wanted to be invisible, but I couldn't because a lot of kids came up to me and said they were sorry and it's too bad about what happened. They were just being nice, I know, but I couldn't think of what to say back. Plus, I didn't feel as though I belonged in school that day. Everyone else was in a good mood because of it being Friday, and spring break was the following week. But I just wanted to find JT. Then I wanted to be left alone. I waited for JT at his locker during 6-minute break, but he never showed up. so I went on to social studies by myself, knowing I'd see him there, in class. I was supposed to sleep over JT's house that night, only I was thinking of backing out on him because I wasn't up for it. Then again, I thought it might be good to watch a movie and play a bunch of video games and stuff. I didn't know. I was mixed up. So when I saw JT finally come through the door, I was relieved. "Hey," I said, when JT took the seat beside me where he always sits. "How you doing?" he asked. "Not so good," I replied, rolling my eyes. "It's been really awful." JT nodded. "I'll bet." I thought he was going to say something else, but he didn't. He sort of paused, then reached into his backpack and pulled a book up onto his desk. He started looking through it like he was searching for homework or something, but we didn't have any that I knew of. "JT," I said, "about tonight."
"Tonight?"
"Yeah, you wanted me to come over, remember?"
"Oh, gee," he replied before getting this weird look, like he just remembered something. "Tonight, Brady, I don't think we can do it."
"No big deal," I said, trying to make light of it. After all, I was relieved.
"Wasn't I?"
"We've got all next week off," I said. "We can do something later." JT shot a quick glance at me.
"Actually, we won't be home. We're going down to North Carolina to visit my aunt and uncle."
I stared at him because JT's family hardly ever went anywhere, on account of their chicken farm. He must have known what I was thinking. "My dad's not going." Just then our teacher, Mr. Figley, came in the room and loudly closed the door so we'd all shut up. After class, I spoke briefly with Mr. Figley about making up the test I had missed. Then I tried to catch up with JT, just for the walk downstairs. He went to Spanish and I went to math. But he had slipped into the crowd and disappeared. Later in the hall between third and fourth periods, I saw Digger, and I know he saw me, because I watched him do a double take and then turn a complete 180. Then, back at my locker, where I stopped to switch books, Kate came up to me. She was still on crutches because of her ankle, so her girlfriend Ryan carried her backpack.
"Sorry about Ben," she said.
"Me too, it's really sad," Ryan added.
"Thanks," I muttered.
Kate had her brown hair pulled up and back into two ponytails like a little kid. But it was cute. When I bent down to pick up my books, she said,
"I guess I'll see you tonight. Mom said you were coming over."
Surprised, I straightened up.
"I thought you were going to North Carolina."
Kate's eyes widened. "What are you talking about?"
"JT said..."
And it hit me fast. JT had made up the story because he didn't want me over.
"I'm confused," I mumbled, scrambling to figure out why. "I guess I got it mixed up."
Ryan was nudging Kate.
"Yeah, we have to go," Kate said. "See ya, Brady."
"See ya," I said.
But as she hobbled away with Ryan, I stood there wondering, why would JT lie to me? And why would Digger not even want to talk to me? I needed to get to class. Lockers slammed, everyone was hustling. Ernie Bodkin knocked my shoulder as he rushed by. But I stood there, staring. I didn't get it. The bell rang. I was going to be late. But I didn't much care, because I just didn't get it.
Chapter 11. There was a funeral for Ben a couple days later. A friend of the D'Angelos called to invite us. The funeral was out in Leesburg, Virginia, where they're from. But I didn't want to go. My parents said that was fine. They said they understood if I didn't want to go. But I think Mom worried about me. The day of the funeral, she asked me to drive into Centreville with her to help with the grocery shopping and errands. And she took me to lunch at Pizza Hut, and we almost never eat lunch out. I could feel her keeping an eye on me while I played with the straw in my soda. Pushing her salad plate to the side, Mom picked up her coffee and said,
"Brady, you need to put this behind you and move forward."
Her words echoed Carl's.
"I know," I agreed,
But how do you do that? Every day I kept thinking about what had happened on the river, and I couldn't seem to get the traction I needed for forward motion. "Do you want to take the rest home?" Mom asked gently. I stared at the uneaten half of my small pizza, not caring, but I nodded because we never waste food. Across the street, Mom pulled into a parking place at the new shopping center my father hated because it had sprung up in what used to be a cornfield where he went hunting as a kid. I wasn't particular. In fact, I never minded an excuse to go anywhere outside of our town, if you can call it that. All we have at Bailey's Wharf is a crossroads near school where there's a post office and the firehouse, a gas station that sells bait, a video store, and the 7-Eleven. "You all right?" Mom asked, pulling the keys out of the ignition. "Yeah." She handed me a piece of paper with the things Dad needed from the hardware store and a $20 bill. "I'll meet you back here in half an hour, okay?" When I finished buying the clamps and sandpaper Dad needed, I saw that I still had 20 minutes before meeting Mom. So I drifted into the dollar store to poke around and remembered I needed batteries for my CD player. Some little kids were in the store examining the new Spider-Man action figure, seeing what it could do. I thought of Ben, and I couldn't help myself. I tried to imagine what his funeral was like. I had never been to a funeral, not even Amanda's. Carl took me up to the National Aquarium in Baltimore the day they buried my sister, and I didn't know until it was over. I'm sure my parents thought they were protecting me, but I always felt cheated, like it left yet another hole in my life. It irritates me even now when I think of how I rode all those escalators to see a bunch of fancy seahorses and polka-dotted fish when I could have been saying goodbye to Amanda one last time.